brought to you by Burr Foreman and broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Results Matter Radio, where we bring you pertinent business information and offer real-life solutions to help drive desired results for you, whatever your business may be.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Results Matter Radio, brought to you by our friends at Burr and Foreman. Stone, how are you doing today?
Good morning, sir. I am doing well, but I had to come to work and get some rest. You know, we had the big wedding up at the winery over the weekend. I got family in town. I'm up every morning cooking bacon and sausage, and I'm ready to take a break.
That's right. So that's why you're here doing the show?
Yeah. We got the studios full this morning. This is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to visit with Lynn Turknet. And they've got this award, and we have a studio full of winners. We're all winners here, Lee.
That's the way it should be.
All right. Well, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast Miss Lynn Turknet. How you doing?
I'm doing well this morning.
So can you share a little bit about what the award is and how it got started?
Absolutely. The awards are based on our leadership character model. And we created, Bob, my husband and I, who are here, he's my business partner, and we've been married too many years to count. But we developed a leadership character model in 1995 because we thought, after seeing a lot of leaders doing a lot of reading and research, that leadership is first about who you are before it's about what you do. And that model is grounded in integrity and has a balance of respect on one side and responsibility on the other. Well, we'd been using this model for our leadership development work and our coaching. And in the early 2000s, if you remember, there were a lot of things in our business community that were going really wrong. That's when we had the Enron scandals and the WorldCom scandals. And we knew two things. One, we saw a lot of really good people in leadership in business, and we really wanted to lift those people up. The other thing was we thought it would be a good teaching moment for business people, for all the people in the community, if they could see good role models instead of the ones that were on radio and TV right then. So actually, Susan Hitchcock and our firm came up with the idea for the awards in 2002. We got our first nominations in 2003, and the first award ceremony was in February of 2004.
Now, how does it happen where a company can get so off track when it comes to integrity or leadership and character in their business, where they can go so far off the reservation that it, you know, you can get a Madoff situation or an Enron or WorldCom situation? Like, does that happen incrementally, and one bad decision leads to another, and it just keeps getting worse and worse?
We could talk for hours about the answer to that question, but I do think it tends to be incremental. And I think one of the things that happens is senior leaders have to be really concerned about ethics and integrity. One of the things we know is that people have a hard time thinking about business and financial decisions and ethical decisions at the same time. So you have to be willing to consciously bring the ethical component of any decision into every decision you're making. I'm going to tell this is a really quick research study that I love that tells the reason why. Dan Ariely, who's a neuroscientist, does a lot of studies about when people are honest. And he's done studies where he divides groups into two, gives them really hard math tests. One group, he lets them grade their own answers. In the other group, he takes them up and grades them himself. You want to tell me which group you think gets more right answers?
Which group?
The group that grades themselves.
So they don't get more right answers. They say they get
they
more right answers.
They say they get more right answers, exactly. And one of the interesting things, one of the things we always ask groups, so what do you think changed the behavior? There's something you can do that will make everybody not cheat even if they grade their own papers. And the thing that you can do that makes people not cheat
is put a mirror in front of them?
Well, that might work. But the other thing that works is you remind them of their values. And interestingly, even if people are not religious, if you show them the Ten Commandments, they won't cheat. And wow. So that's a telling story for what it takes in business or in nonprofits, in any organization. You have to keep your values out in front of you personally and organizationally. So that's kind of what we're trying to do with this.
And you're trying to let folks know about it. You have some of your winners here. Introduce some
yes.
of your winners, if you will.
Well, it's very exciting to see all these people here. Kathy Colbinson is a wonderful, she's the head of Chris Kids. I've known her and known about her for a long time. And it was wonderful to see her nominations. And I'll tell you how many, two of the people here got multiple nominations. And Kathy got many nominations, all of them talking about what a great job she does as a leader of values. And I'm going to let her tell you later the values that Chris stands for. We have Marcy McCarthy from TEN, and she has been nominated before. Her nominations also, I think you got more than one, and they were one of the things that's so much fun, and I will tell you, Bob and I do not make the decision about who wins. We have a panel of five judges now who make that decision, and we're really glad, because I'll tell you, the nominations are, you can feel the heart and the respect that people have for these people when you read them. We also have Jim McGarra here. Jim is somebody we have actually known for a long time since we have admired his leadership since he was a leader in Bell South. He has been an admiral in the Navy and is now at Georgia Tech Research Institute. He also had multiple nominations and is one of those people that everybody loves to follow, and he has, to us, a great blend of integrity, respect, and responsibility. Andy Lippman is also here. He was our Inspirator Award winner this year, and the Inspirators are folks who, despite, they don't even have to have a leadership position, but they take leadership, they do things, and he is someone who has overcome a lot of personal, physical health difficulties himself to do some wonderful things in the world.
So let's hear from Kathy first. Kathy, I want to hear a little bit from you about what do you think shaped your mindset, your values that brought you to this point?
I was really blessed to have two parents who were both people of great integrity, and in particular, my dad is a Baptist minister who took stands during the civil rights time and was always someone who acted on his belief system. So I had a great role model growing up on doing the right thing and in being humble about it. But always, when you're at a decision point, being guided by your values and your belief system. So I was lucky. It was easy for me.
Now, can you talk a little bit about the organization, Chris Kids?
Well, of course, I think Chris Kids is the best nonprofit in Atlanta. And what we do is unlock human potential. We focus on children, adults, and families who are traumatized, who've been victimized by life circumstances, by abuse and neglect. And we, I think, provide services that offer a really good balance between uplifting people and holding people accountable. We teach to fish.
Right.
So that's, I think, what's really important about what we do.
Now, when you're communicating to them and helping them through a tough time like this, how do the leadership awards and the messages behind that, how does that help you do what you do?
Well, Chris Kids is a values-driven organization, first and foremost. Our name is an acronym for our values: creativity, honor, respect, integrity, and safety.
Okay, so it's woven. It's woven into everything.
Into
the
we
DNA
do.
Of the organization.
Right. Because if you think about it, those values are the values that are essential building blocks for success.
But when you're dealing with a kid who maybe hasn't been brought up with those values and you're trying to educate him on these values, how is it difficult? Is it easy? Does some things resonate quicker? Like, how is it when you're dealing with a kid who hasn't been kind
of... I believe it's about role modeling.
Okay.
It's about my behavior. It's about the staff behavior, the therapist's behavior. The first and foremost, we accept people for who they are, where they are, and we treat everybody with respect.
Right.
And so it starts with respect and honoring differences and diversity and always doing what we say we're going to do.
But when you're doing that and they're coming from an environment that maybe they're not, the role models aren't that way, how do you win them over and kind of bring them into...
That's got to be tough.
We're persistent.
You have to be.
The water wears away the stone, and so we just keep dripping. And it's really important. You bring who you are to your workplace,
right,
whether it's a nonprofit or a business. And when you're consistent and when you are committed to respecting other people... providing a safe environment, the S stands for safety, then that eventually opens the door. So it's consistent role modeling. It's consistent behavior. And just think about it. If somebody smiles at you on the street, what does that do for you?
Right. You smile back.
Right.
Right. And if you're kind of tenaciously doing that day after day, every time they see you, they
it works.
Know. Right. And then what's it like when you see that aha moment in the kid when the light bulb goes off and they kind of buy in, or you see a behavior maybe that you've taught them that you see them kind of parroting back in when they don't know you're around?
Well, you go, yes. And you celebrate success, because that's a part of helping people grow and change, is you're celebrating for the kids and the families we work with. They get so many messages that they're not enough or not good enough.
Right.
And for us, we celebrate every success. We celebrate the time that they do something good, or that they smile, or that they reach out. We also do volunteerism at Chris Kids. So our clients in each of our programs participate in volunteer activities to give back.
So they have to give back as well.
Right. And we don't force anything,
right,
but we offer.
But how do you hold them accountable? Like, how do you give them that tough love where you need them, you would like them to behave a certain way, and maybe they're kind of being a little tough?
Well, you know, most of our kids that we work with and our families are tough. And we don't stand in the way of natural consequences. But we don't expect perfection. You know, progress is two steps up and one back. And the important thing is actually, as human beings, we learn most from our mistakes. And so, you know, mistakes or poor choices are learning opportunities, and that's how we treat
them. So that's how you frame it.
Yeah, we don't give up, and we frame everything as a learning opportunity.
Right.
And sometimes there is tough love, because we don't stand in the way of a natural consequence,
right,
but we're still there. And once you're in the Chris Kids family, you're always in
the family.
You don't get out of
they're
it.
They're stuck with you now, right?
Right. They cannot, you know, they cannot stop us from caring about them. And they cannot stop us. I call it good old-fashioned parental harassment. You know, with your kids, you are constantly encouraging them to do the right things or to make good choices or think about how they make choices. But that's what we're doing. We're helping kids think about what are their options, what are their alternatives broadly.
And repercussions. Right,
right, right. Because, but people don't really make decisions based on being able to think in the future about bad consequences. People usually make decisions based on short-term rewards. And so we're very aware of that. And so we build in as much short-term recognition and attaboys as possible.
And then, so now, how is this award, like you got involved with the award, you won the award. How does that impact your life at Chris Kids?
Well, I'm just incredibly touched and humbled by having won the award. You know, I was telling Lynn I expected other people to win the award because the other nominees are all such terrific people, so it's really humbling. And I guess for me, it underscores the importance of being values-driven, the importance of knowing when to lead and when to follow. I mean, I think a good leader hires people that are smarter than them. It makes them look good.
Right.
And then gets out of the way to do the work and coaches and, you know, really is committed to the higher goal, the higher mission.
Right, the bigger why.
Yeah, the bigger why, because it's all about that at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. What is the stated mission and purpose of Christ Kids? How would you articulate that?
Our mission's to heal children, strengthen families, and build community.
Mm-hmm. And you do that primarily through the child, or is the parent involved as well?
Through the whole family.
The entire family?
Yeah, it depends on, we have a family of services that involves the Christ Counseling Center, that involves group homes for kids in foster care, that involves adoptions for kids in foster care, if anybody wants to adopt. We have an adoption program, and we focus on children who are in foster care who've lingered in foster care.
So what, this is older kids?
Nine and up.
We do
adoptions of younger kids and of sibling groups.
Uh-huh.
But our focus is on those kids that have been labeled as hard to adopt. One of our other programs is an apartment complex for homeless young adults who are aging out of foster care or homeless by virtue of some other reason. And what we really want to do is we want to help those kids be adopted so they don't age out, because people need each other. People need families.
Right.
We also do training. So we do child abuse prevention. We do mental health first aid. We do a lot of trauma training because the population we work with has been traumatized. So we believe in recovery and resilience, and that no matter what a person has gone through, they can achieve success if they're given the right array of services and support systems.
And it seems that role modeling is a key component to this.
It's key. You got to walk your talk.
Right.
Because if you don't walk your talk, it undermines everything else you do.
Well, listen, I want you to stay on the mic and pay attention, because I want to bring Jim McGarrett into this conversation. He is with the Georgia Tech Research Institute. And did I hear you were an admiral?
Retired admiral.
Retired admiral.
So you don't do much admiraling?
Every once in a while, I get an opportunity to do it informally. For instance, last night I was at a Business Executives for National Security dinner where we welcomed retired General Norty Swartz, the former Air Force Chief of Staff, to the Southeast region. And we were actually talking about things like this, like values, like being part of something that's bigger than yourself. And like being a trusted agent. And that's what BINS does, and that's actually what Georgia Tech Research Institute does.
So can you share a little bit about what the Georgia Tech Research Institute is doing?
Yeah, what are you researching?
Well, let me I'll use GTRI because it's easier to say. The Georgia legislature back in the early 1900s recognized the need for technology transfer mechanism in the state of Georgia to help fuel economic development. And so we were founded in 1934 as the Georgia Tech Engineering Experiment Station with about a dozen or so employees. We're now about 1,750 employees. About 300 of those at any one time are students. And we find it fascinating with a four-generation workforce now that, you know, the undergraduate co-op student and the 35-year researcher bring different perspectives to this very fast-paced, changing technology world. And it's really pretty neat to try to figure out how to combine those perspectives to find solutions for our customers.
And then who are your customers?
Our customers largely now are the federal government. About 90% of our portfolio, either in Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, Department of Defense, and Health and Human Services. I'll mention one example, the Amber Alert System on the highways.
Oh, yeah.
The underlying information exchange standards that the FBI uses to transmit that information were developed in Georgia Tech in the Research Institute and are now being adopted by Homeland Security, DOD, and Health and Human Services. So, you know, it's sort of a novel approach to bring multiple agencies together using common standards so we can share information securely and more robustly.
Now, are you seeing that? It seems like if you look at the rollout of the Obamacare, where the technology is being done in multiple places, and they're having a tough time at the federal level, at least sharing that information. Is that some of the stuff that you guys help with?
We do applications like that. The vast majority of our research is funded by outside sponsors, outside money. In other words, we get very little money from the state. We get about $6 or $7 million from the state for education programs, agricultural support programs, severe storm warning programs. But the rest of our about $300 million in annual revenues come from outside work. And we are actually, I don't think I said that we are the applied research arm of Georgia Tech. So we're actually building things, developing things, delivering products and services within timelines. We're sort of like a not-so-small small business within the university.
But is when you're working with the government and there's a variety of silos you have to navigate, is that one of the challenges is to get the information and so that everybody works together?
He puts his admiral hat on, picks up the phone, and it's a done
deal. Well, that's why it would make sense to hire somebody from the military
that
can get something done.
Well, it's interesting that you mention that. Working across the interagency is sometimes challenging, but our researchers respond to very discreet requests for work. But there are other of our sponsors who come to us that have similar problems. And what we find is that we become an information-sharing mechanism between sponsors so that mm-hmm. we can leverage prior work into new solutions.
Right. Like if every state had an Amber Alert and they didn't speak to each other, that would kind of defeat
exactly.
the purpose, right?
Exactly. Yeah, so that kind of system interoperability and common standards help not only allow people to talk to each other, but to do it in a secure way so that that information is not compromised.
Now, from a leadership standpoint, how does having a military background impact your life in the university setting?
Well, it's interesting. My wife says I can't hold a job because I'm retired from the military, from federal government, and from Bell South, now AT&T, and now I'm in academia. And what I find is academia experiences the same kinds of issues that any big organization experiences. Mm-hmm. We sometimes have a different language. We sometimes have a different uniform, maybe different processes. But the issues are fundamentally the same. So a lot of what I experienced in the military, including leading a unit in combat, helps me to understand a frame of reference that I can apply now in the academic world to help us move our team to the next level.
Now, how do you, in a military setting, I can understand the sense of urgency and the sense of purpose. In a university or a bureaucratic arena where there's less urgency or the less the feel of urgency, how do you kind of communicate that and lead in that manner?
I mentioned that GTRI is really more like a small business than the university. We're an integral part of the university. But we are driven by timelines and production dates and deliverables and budgets. So from that perspective, it's not a whole lot different than my experience in Bell South. We have the additional advantage of being able to reach into campus not only for students, but to world-class faculty. And we try to blend those together within the constraints of our sponsors' requirements, blend those together to get the solutions that we seek for their problems.
Now, how do you bubble up kind of best practices and share that throughout the organization?
We're actually, I say we're 1,750. We've grown 50% in staffing and in revenues in the last 5 years. And so we, like any organization with that kind of growth, are challenged in trying to bring together, in a more aligned way, bring together our different business units, our different laboratories. We are putting in place processes and systems that help facilitate the sharing of that information. For instance, we just brought one system online that our researchers populate with abstracts and keywords of work that they've done for sponsors, so that if I get a new sponsor award today, I can go in and look and see if something else has happened within the research institute, and then I can contact those researchers and help collaborate with them and build on what they've already done.
Now, collaboration is important in a lot of organizations where everybody's working together for the same goal. Is it a challenge in your group, especially in a fast-growing group where, you know, when you bring on that many people, how do you kind of instill that level of collaboration?
It's a challenge because the technology is moving so fast, and our laboratories are loosely aligned around technology sectors. but the technology constantly changes and the marketplace constantly changes. So the challenge that we have is how do we blur the boundaries between whatever administrative structure we have in place, and how do we help people realize that the real objective is to optimize the solutions we provide to our customers by drawing on whatever resource we have across the Institute.
So let's get some real leadership counsel here, because I'm operating under the impression that even in a military organization like the Navy, much less the GRTI, you can't pull this off with authority alone. There must be something that you and people like you and the people in this room are able to do to generate predictable results with and through other people consistently. And it's got to be more than authority, yeah?
I don't think you can pull it off with authority, period. I think you have to rely on the kinds of values that we discussed earlier. Our values are integrity, innovation, and excellence, with integrity being first. I think we have to model the behaviors that we want. I think we need to encourage and provide incentives for collaboration, for successes, and then, as was discussed earlier, celebrate those successes. I'm actually going out to our Cobb County facility immediately after this for a town hall with our two labs that are out there. And the vast majority of the formal information we're going to present is celebrating the individual and team recognitions from our work this past year.
Now, when you're working with somebody who's new to the organization, how do you kind of tell their level of integrity? How do you screen for integrity?
You know, that really is pretty subjective, and we leave that very much to our hiring managers. But our hiring managers and our leadership looks for evidence throughout the probation period. Basically, there's about a six-month probation period where we can observe.
So you put like a $20 bill on the ground, and they walk by it, and they hand, somebody dropped this.
Yeah, I'm not sure 20 is sufficient these days, but... what we do is we pair new employees up with existing employees, and they help learn.
So mentoring and role modeling,
exactly,
the values.
What the values are, what the processes are, what we find important, and what we reward.
And can you coach someone up on integrity? What do you think? That's just kind of a personality trait.
By the time they get to us, you've formed, for the most part, your fundamental values. Mm-hmm. We can highlight opportunities for improvement, and some of our folks are responsive to that. But there are natural consequences for behavior and for decisions. And we are promoting what we're referring to consistently as a culture of compliance, and that is compliance with our values, compliance with our processes. We are state employees, so we fall under the purview and the scrutiny of being state employees. And it's up to us to make sure that we are an honorable institution to continue those trusted relationships that we enjoy with our sponsors and with our partners.
Now, what was it like? What was your reaction when you heard that you were getting the TurkNet Award?
I was surprised when I heard that I was being nominated, because I think it was my wife that led the clandestine effort to submit the nominations, and then I get out of the blue, I get a letter from the TurkNet saying congratulations. So, but frankly, when my name was called, I was also humbled. I mean, look at the caliber of the people in this room. It's an amazing experience.
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to follow Kathy or Jim talking about leadership on the air, but then I don't have to. I'm just going to introduce our next winner. Please join me in welcoming to the show the Grand Poobah, the CEO, President, Managing Partner with Tech Exec Networks, Marcy McCarthy.
Hello. I don't know how I top that intro there.
So tell us a little bit about your work and what you're out there trying to do for folks.
What we do at 10 is actually enable lines of communication, enabling IT and information security executives to connect, collaborate, and celebrate through our ISE programs.
She's answered that question before, I think.
We showcase and honor leading IT and information security executives and their project teams on a regional and national basis. So when I was honored at the TurkNet Awards a few weeks ago, I actually knew what our nominees felt like for the first time. It was a lot of pressure and a lot of excitement, and a certainly very honoring and humbling experience. But our programs bring together the IT information security executive or the professional community on a U.S. and Canadian basis. And we put on 6 different ISE award programs a year. 5 of them are in the United States. 4 of those are regional, South ISE Southeast, ISE Central, ISE West, ISE Northeast. And we also added this year ISE Canada, and it was the following day of the TurkNet Awards, and literally I had won my award, gave my acceptance speech, and flew out to the airport, literally, and made it to my gate in 25 minutes and actually made it to our event in Toronto. And then we culminate the program actually for the ISE North America Leadership Summit and Awards Gala, which for us will be next week in D.C., Tyson's Corner.
Now, being a successful woman in the technology field, that's kind of, I don't want to say, it's unusual, right? There's not a lot of women in technology, and you're pretty active in that world as well.
Yes, I am. I got involved with women in technology back when I moved to Atlanta in 1994 and became very passionate about the Atlanta technology community as a whole. And in fact, the ISE programs were founded based upon the Woman of the Year awards that WIT puts on each year. I chaired that program for 5 years and got a ton of experience building up an award program for what it is today. When we started, the ceiling really hadn't broken for the women out there in the technology industry, and we feel that we've done at 10 is broken the glass ceiling for chief information security officers and the equivalents in the U.S. and Canada.
Now, can you share with our listeners a little bit about the percentage of women in leadership in technology? Do you know the percentage or a ballpark of the percentage?
I don't know the overall. I've seen it increase, and I think the importance of organizations like WIT and the STEM programs in which they support are critical. There's been a lot of girls types of programs that are aimed towards technology. Robotics has actually a girls team and everything like that. What I see in our programs is it's predominantly men. There's very few women. We will put on a ISE private dinner, and my staff and myself might be the only females there. Want to encourage more women to get into the field of cybersecurity and information security. There's many exciting opportunities, and I don't think the glass ceiling is quite broken there. It's not that the door isn't open. It's just that women have not taken advantage of the great opportunities that exist in that profession.
Now, as a leader in this industry, how are you helping educate and motivate women to get in this and to stay in it?
Our program at the ISE programs are not gender-based.
Right.
We're honoring security executives, regardless of gender, the best of the best in our profession. I think what I've been able to do on a personal level, my entire company for the most part is men. I'm sorry, women. Sorry. I'm sorry. Sorry. I'm like,
we'll fix it in post. Don't worry.
is female. So, we have, a mentoring system within ourselves, a leadership that catapults these great, women to do wonderful
things. So you're reaching out
to
younger, like college aged, maybe giving them job shadowing and.
We had an intern actually from the Atlanta Girls School this summer work with us. Her mom is the chief information security officer actually at the Coca-Cola company here in Atlanta. And she approached us saying her daughter needed some guidance and mentorship of strong female women working in the technology field. Would you spend some time with her? And we did. We gave her a research project. She had to go out and research different companies and determine their what industry they fell in terms of categorization, and ported that into Salesforce.com. She got exposure to the email management tool that we use, Constant Contact. So she had a, and she also was asked to review our website for functionality. And, you know, over time, those links break. I mean, text is wrong or things. And we are updating our website. We actually have 2 full, pretty large websites that are updated on a daily basis. So you need someone to go through and from a QA perspective to review what is actually out there. So we had a great experience with her, and she really does want to have a career in technology. Now, we're a small company, so I can't take a ton of kids, young women in.
We'll send them over to Jim. He knows what to do with them, right, Jim?
Right, he's got 17.
We'd be glad to employ him.
But again, we were thrilled to have that opportunity.
But again, it was role modeling again. It seems to be the methodology of transferring this kind of values-based information.
Absolutely. And that's the integrity that we put forth for all of our, within all of our programs and how we work with our clients. Our clients are the Symantecs of the world, the HPs, the McAfees. They underwrite all of our programs. They want to ultimately do business with the chief information security officers. But at the end of the day, if you do not deliver every single time, your best program was your last program, and they quickly forget.
Right. You got to earn that integrity at every project.
And our business is really built upon reputation, referral, overall, and repeat business. So our clients come back to us over and over again for more programs. They go to other job opportunities. They bring us in their pocket as part of their marketing and sales plans. Mm-hmm. So our customer base has actually grown exponentially over the last couple of years because of those job transfers. And actually, a lot of the folks that we work with behind the scenes in the marketing and marketing organizations in which we serve are actually a lot of women that are in technology.
Now, so relationships are extremely important to you.
They're the foundation of what we are.
And then when you're working a partnership or beginning a new relationship, can you walk us through what that engagement looks like when they're just getting to know you?
If they're coming out of the gate as a new client, oftentimes they actually been referred to
us. It's a referral-based business,
it's a referral,
right?
Exactly. Or they might have worked with us or heard about us from another client.
Mm-hmm. You're not trusting just anybody's cousin to your cybersecurity stuff, right? I mean, this is really a high relationship.
It really is. The cybersecurity industry and information security overall is based upon trust. And if you breach that trust one time, you're done. The executives in which that participate in our programs, the clients that we serve, you cannot breach their trust. And you have to, earn their respect as well. We work with competitive companies. On one given day, I might be on the phone with McAfee. I might be on the phone with Symantec. In my world, that's like being on the phone with Coke and Pepsi or Burger King and McDonald's. But we make sure we silo their information. We do not share their sales information, their sales objectives, the marketing objectives of the program across any of the clientele that we work with.
How do you have a conversation? I'm sure you started with one of them before you got the other one. How do you make them feel comfortable? How do you make each of them feel comfortable that they're the trust will be there and their information will be siloed?
That is actually my team. They're amazing. My team is led by Brooke Cook, and she leads the client calls in conjunction, depending upon the kind of project or engagement we're working on, with Heather Burgess. So giving you ladies a call out on the internet. But at the end of the day, we ensure that we have a methodology that we have defined, all the processes for every single program in which we start. It is somewhat of a checklist, but we make sure that we hit that checklist every single time and have the key points of discussion. Whether if we're doing a dinner program, which is a custom dinner program, and it's like, oh, it's just a dinner program. But there's a lot of work that goes into one of our dinner programs. We'll start and try to understand what the business objectives are of the program. How does that align? The content, how's that going to align with what they do in terms of products and services? What kind of audience they want there? Yeah, they want the chief information security officer, but of what companies? What accounts are important to them? What accounts they're wanting to do business that they're not doing business with today? We want to enable those channels of communication to happen. We want to walk them through our audience development process, where we're actually bringing the right people and inviting the right people to the program, and of course, getting them there. There's a lot that goes into it, all the creative, all the email communications, both personal and more on a, not quite a mass, they're very personalized in what we do, but all the ingredients that go into having that executive pick our program out of all the invitations that they might get in a given week. And our success ultimately is measured on who comes to the dinner and then the kind of experience that they have. We've opened up...
Because you're building relationships for your clients.
Exactly.
So that's the metric exactly. they use for success, right?
Exactly. So, you know, we survey the folks that attend our programs. Have you heard of this client before? Did you know that they were doing this? Do you want to meet with this client? Do you want more information? And I'm proud to say, after all of our dinners, most of our clients get meetings and deals. More importantly, deals. And we've seen some of these deals come in that can really give quite the ROI for the marketing investment they made
dinner,
with us.
Right?
Exactly. Exactly.
So I want to ask all three of you. I'm going to start with Jim. How do you hire a Brooke Cook? Where do you find a Brooke Cook? A team like she describes, it just strikes me as an incredible challenge. Or do you just have to hire people and then build a Brooke Cook?
Well, luck plays a lot into it. But our folks who are in leadership positions who do the hiring know what we're looking for, know what the values are. Mm-hmm. A lot of the folks that come and apply to us have come from referrals from other folks. Either they've been associated with sponsors that we've done work for and they've gotten to know us there, or they know somebody who has come to work for us and they get referred because they've got the kinds of skill sets that we're looking for. On the other end of the spectrum are students. A lot of those 300-plus students that we have at any one time are interns and undergrads, and we end up hiring a good number of our students that start with students because they've had experience with us, they get to know us, we get to know them, they understand the culture and what's important, and when they graduate, they're Georgia Tech grads, so we hire them.
Can't go wrong.
Kathy, what's your take on this build or find?
I think it's both. I think you have to hire very intentionally. I think hire slow, fire fast if you've made a mistake. But we ask open-ended questions a lot. We ask for examples and scenarios because what we're trying to do is you've got skills and talents. So you need skills and talents. But a fit in an organization is about who a person is. And so we're very intentional in the process about the questions we ask to try to get at their values, to try to get at their work ethic, try to get at creativity as one of our values, at their ability to think out of the box and to not get thrown off by barriers, because in working with the kids and the families we work with the limited resources that we have, being able to work through barriers to accomplish goals is really important. So we also use interview panels. So we have a strategy because also diversity is really important to us because we accept people for who they are, where they are, and we have a very diverse population of our staff and of who we serve. So we're asking a lot of open-ended questions. And then after you bring someone in, then you're teaching them about the values and your role modeling. And sometimes people get through the hiring process and it's in our new employee orientation, which is a minimum of 40 hours that somebody, something surfaces. And so sometimes somebody's let go then, or you know what you need to work on to develop them. But there's some things that are, if you can't treat people with respect and you can't honor diversity,
and
you're not going to make it at Chris Kidd.
And I would think that there's a lot of frustration in they'd have to manage that frustration.
Right, because there are a lot of challenges.
Right.
And people have to be able to, even at higher levels in the organization, there's no job that is beneath anyone at Chris Kidd's. So.
All right, let's find out from Marcy what really happened. Where'd you find this lady? How'd you build this team? Because, I know they sound phenomenal, and you wouldn't even talk about them in that regard on the air unless they really were doing some fantastic work.
Well, it was a lot through relationships, so I got
there
to know.
You go again. It's relationships.
Brooke actually had just recently, this was when I first met her, had moved to Atlanta and was contracting for one of our clients. And she, we got to know her during the ISC programs planning process for ISC Southeast. She impressed me out of the gate. She kept us on our toes. She was the queen of task masking. At the end of the day, she was someone I really admired and I knew I had to have as my chief of staff and really running my ship on the delivery side of our programs. She knows how to mentor people, manage people. She knows how to politely talk to an executive and not quite stalk them, but stalk them. Even our clients, who are sometimes not always on top of their deliverable time frames. But she's really mastered the craft of being really personable and but explaining the importance of why the time frame of something has to happen. And I think our entire team looks up to her. She just had a baby recently, so she has...
Congratulations, Brooke.
Oh, wow. But she has really exemplified to me as a person that can do it all. And we're really thrilled. And I love her to death, so I appreciate her every day.
Well, and you've created an environment, obviously, that continues to cultivate that and support that. That's fantastic. I got to know the backstory, because Jim and Kathy both mentioned a lot of this does start early. You know, he mentioned kids coming to them with a lot of their values in place. Tell us your backstory. How did you get into this world?
Well, I went to Babson College up in Massachusetts and realized that I didn't want to be cold all winter and moved to Atlanta. It's actually a pretty funny story. I got stuck on a bridge going home from my job. It took me 5 hours to get home on a Friday afternoon. And this is back in 1993, 94, when really cell phone technology was very limited. And when you had the snow coming down about 2 inches an hour, you really didn't get a signal in your car. So you were pretty stranded and felt really by yourself. And the only thing for entertainment you had wasn't your iPhone, was a file of fax. So I started to pretend, where would I like to be right now other than my car? And, of course, the map in the file of fax was only the United States. So I started circling San Francisco, Atlanta, Dallas. And then when I got home, I was one determined young woman to get the heck out of Dodge and started calling the Chamber of Commerce. Again, no internet really right at this juncture. Called the Chamber of Commerce. I called Atlanta Chamber of Commerce and got information about these communities that started, you know, about information, what's it like to live there, what's it like to work there. I also ordered the Sunday papers and had them delivered to my home. And I set up a little business center in my kitchen that was half the size of this room that we're in right now. And rented a fax machine, rented a printer, and had my, you know, PC that took up the entire like kitchenette table. And my Thursday nights were because that's when I got the Sunday paper, was Thursday night, so I was behind the eight ball. So I was typing up my cover letters and getting out my resume and faxing that in. And due to all the 13 storms that we had that winter, blizzards, I could actually work from home and follow up on my resumes. And booked my flight to Atlanta. My dad and mom paid for that ticket. Believed in me. I was like, he's like, my dad had moved to Florida the year before and was like, I want to be,
I get it.
And, moved here with my, you know, suitcase and car and, stayed with a friend from college. I slept on the floor, and a couple weeks later I moved into Post Brookhaven and made a world of friends and got hired by a company called UserTech, another great lady, Betsy Cagle, opened the doors for me to women in technology. And women in technology in 1994, 95 was...
Oxymoron.
we were living in awe of Beta and SSA. TAG didn't even exist yet. The Technology Association of Georgia, that is. And these amazing group of women took me in under their wing and mentored me to the woman I am today. And without them... And the doors that they opened for me in the Atlanta technology community, I am forever grateful. And I want to pass that on, and I hope I've passed that on and continue to do so with my team at 10.
So, Lynn, you have got to be just beaming with pride. How much fun you must have, you and Bob, both just hanging out with people like this, yeah?
Absolutely. And I'll have to tell you, we also hang out. This is an added thing for us. We have done leadership development in this community for over 25 years, and we hang out with a lot of great people. The people who are really excellent in business,
or in nonprofits in any field are wonderful to be around. They have learned a lot, and we firmly believe in our leadership character model. The best of them are great people. They're people you would follow anywhere because you'd trust them. And they'd have, when Marcy's describing Brooke, that's a person who balances respect and responsibility. Somebody who gets it done, who forges ahead, but who also builds fabulous, respectful relationships. And all of these people talked about that kind of thing.
Well, this ride's not over yet.
Lee, we got one more.
It's time for the headliner. The poor guy, he's been patient. We started him out in the cheap seats, and looked like he was taking notes. I did see him nod his head a lot, and definitely been looking forward to this part of the show. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast from Wish for Wendy Foundation, Mr. Andy Lippman. How you doing, man?
I'm good, thank you. I don't mind the cheap seats, by the way. Reminds me of my old days at Fulton County Stadium.
All right, what are we wishing for Wendy? Talk to us about this.
Sure. Wish for Wendy is a foundation my family and I started back in the early 2000s. And the foundation is to benefit the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation and to raise awareness. I lost a sister before I was even born back in 1970. Her name was Wendy Carol Lippman. And so we started the event as a softball tournament. And first year we raised $30,000. And this is we just actually had our 14th this past Saturday where we raised $300,000. So we've raised about $2 million in 14 years. In her memory, and to raise awareness for cystic fibrosis, which is also a disease that I have.
So now, when you're raising money for cystic fibrosis, what does the money go towards? Is it for research? Is it for what?
It's for research. Majority of it's for research, and I will say the great thing about the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, it's actually listed in Forbes as one of the best foundations that gives over 90% of the money to the actual charity as opposed to administrative costs.
And then you mentioned that you have cystic fibrosis. You want to share a little bit about a little education about the disease?
Sure. Cystic fibrosis is a lung disease that also affects the digestive system and the reproductive system. 98% of males with cystic fibrosis cannot have children without any type of fertility drugs or IVF. My wife and I happen to go through it, through the IVF process, and we have two children because of it. But cystic fibrosis mostly affects the lungs. In fact, I was just at my doctor yesterday. You guys hear my voice the way it is right now. It's not because of cystic fibrosis. Actually, it's because of the softball tournament. We were in the cold for 15 and a half hours. But no, it does affect your lungs. So when I do go to the doctor, I do what's called pulmonary function tests. And that's where you breathe as hard as you can, about 6 or 7 times. And they can tell you what level you're at and whether you need to go on oral antibiotics, IV antibiotics, anything like that. So I do about 4 to 5 hours of therapy a day, and I take about 30 to 40 pills per day.
Wow. So what is the status? How far along are we in finding better treatments and getting close to a cure? Have we covered a lot of ground in recent years, or what's the state of the art, I guess?
We're definitely making progress. It's funny, when I was a kid, they used to say 7 to 10 years, and I always thought that was a jail sentence after a while because you kept hearing 7 to 10. But they are making a ton of progress now. They have a new drug called Kalydeco, which helps about 4% of the CF population. I'm not included in that, but I'm still glad that they are finally making progress. It was approved by the FDA, and it has an improved lung function of about 10 to 15% in those patients. And now there are other drugs for other genotypes that are going on, and we're really excited that a lot more people are going to be treated and get stronger, and eventually we'll have a cure.
Now, when you're coming up with these fundraising opportunities, and you're creating the events, right? Is that part of
I
what
am. My sister actually helps. My sister Emily, who's younger, who's actually on the new Atlanta it's a Bravo show, where she actually no competitor there, but but she definitely talks about cystic fibrosis while she's on the show, and she actually had a fashion show while she was on there. So I do kind of the softball tournaments. I do, as I tell her, the old man stuff, the stuff that, and she does the fashion shows at midnight. I come in for about 3 minutes and then I go home because I'm exhausted. But she does all the young stuff. I do all the older stuff. But we combine, we raise a lot of money for CF.
Now, when you're building your team, how do the TurkNet leadership values, how do they come into play in your organization?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I granted, it's nonprofit, but I still use referrals. But I also look at those people. I'm on other boards. And when I'm on a board, I look at the people who raise their hand the most, who speak the most, who go outside the box the most. that's a big thing for me, is going outside the box, who's not afraid to ask a question, who's not afraid to implement something that someone else may not try. So the people that are on our board, several members of my family, my wife Andrea, my mom Eva, who's amazing, who gets so much food for our event, but she really likes to think, well, we could do this and we could do that. But what I like is people that go outside the box and try to do something that hasn't been done before. Even if it fails, you got to try. I think there's an old line from John F. Kennedy where he says 100% of the times you don't try, you fail. And the thing is, you got to try something. You never know. It may just work, and it may just work really well.
Now, how do you create that culture in your company that where failure is an option, where the person doesn't get in trouble? Or, you know, a lot of organizations, if you fail, you could be fired. You know, there's always that
right.
fear attached to failing. But it sounds like you guys are encouraging that.
Yeah, absolutely. We tell them just it's okay if you want to try something a little bit new. It's okay. If it doesn't work, it's okay. Let's give it a shot. That's one thing I always say is let's give it a shot. Unless I really don't think it's going to work and I could see it backfiring. But there are things we try all the time. We're always thinking outside the box, something that could help the event. When we first wanted to do fashion shows, we were like, I don't think that's going to be real successful. But my sister has done an amazing job, and she's raised a lot of money through that. When I first came out to start Wish for Wendy, I remember walking in the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation office, and they looked at me like, okay, so how are you going to do this? I'm like, I have no idea. I thought you guys might help with that. I started writing things down. I came up with ideas, and I got a lot of good people on my side to help me, and it has worked out to be an amazing event. We get celebrities there. We get a lot of people advertising for it. So it's, you never know. I mean, there are going to be a lot of times where things fail, but that's okay, because there are going to be a lot of things that are going to be really successful as well.
How do you communicate your passion to getting celebrities and high-level people to attend and participate?
I tell them my story, and that usually does it. I tell them how I had a sister. I never got to meet her. I didn't find out she had CF until I was 25 years old. Then I began writing books, telling my story, but also saying why I wanted to do stuff for my sister. In fact, every few years I go to her grave and kind of tell her what we've done. I left a softball at her grave a few years ago that said we reached $1 million, because I knew I wanted her to know it was in her memory. Mm-hmm. But I wanted people to know that story. It's not made up. I don't try to, I guess you would say, try to push it too much, try to make it like it's a lifetime movie. But what I do try to do is tell the truth and to use those values and a lot of the values at TurkNet that I am one of those people. I try to be very ethical and I try to do the right thing. But at the same time, I'm going to go out and I'm going to tell you I'm not afraid of the word no. One of the things my mom did, it's a quick little story for you, is I don't know if you guys know who Isaac Hayes is, but he recently passed away a few years ago. But my mom saw him running, this was about 25, 30 years ago, saw him running down West Paces Ferry, and she stopped him. And that took a lot of guts right there. But she said, you know, we're doing this charity event. This is way before Wish for Wendy. This was her own event. And she goes, I would really love it if you could do something, bring something out, something like that. And he goes, sure. They started walking away. And everybody told my mom, you're crazy. You can't go up to someone like that. First of all, they're not going to come anyway. But second of all, you could get in a lot of trouble. I mean, he could have bodyguards. He could have all this. Back then, you didn't have the internet, so she wasn't on TV as a stalker or anything or on the internet. But it comes out a couple weeks later, they have the event. These guys walk in, these big guys, and these people are like, these big guys are looking for you, Eva. And my mom wasn't scared. She goes, okay. They came in. They're like, this is for Mr. Hayes. And they brought in all this autographed memorabilia from him. They ended up making a lot of money off it. And from that, I learned from my mom, never be afraid to hear the word no, mm-hmm. because she wasn't.
So your parents were involved in generating funds for cystic fibrosis before you got involved?
They were. My mom started something called the Santa Claus House many years ago, and they raised a lot of money that way. And my father has been in connection with a lot of people trying to get funds raised for the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. He's been on the board for cystic fibrosis camps, and he's done a lot of great things. And both of them still help me with this event today.
So what's next for you? You got any special plans on the horizon, upcoming events?
Well, you know, since this event just ended, I'm going to enjoy my family.
Take a break.
You know, I'm going to take some time with my wife and my kids and enjoy that, and because I really do. My son is playing soccer now. I love that. My daughter does gymnastics. And my daughter's only 7, but she acts like she's 47. So I'm going to enjoy the fact that she's more mature than I am. But I'm going to enjoy them. But at the same time, I've always got goals in the back of my mind. We just did a music video for cystic fibrosis called I Need a Nebulizer, which is from Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire. You could check it out on YouTube. But we've got a few other songs in the works that they're kind of parodies, but they raise awareness for cystic fibrosis. So that's kind of the newest thing. We're taking a break from writing books and doing some charity events, but we do always try to raise awareness for the disease.
Now, if somebody wanted to learn more, is there a website?
There is. You can go to wishforwendy.org. That's wish for and then W-E-N-D-Y.org. Or you can go to andylipman.com. And you can find out more about what I'm trying to do to raise awareness for the disease and to make a difference in the community.
And Kathy, the website for Chris Kids?
www.chriskids.org. C-H-R-I-S-K-I-D-S.org.
And Marcy?
TEN-INC.com, 10-INC.com.
And Jim?
GTRI.GATECH.EDU.
And who are the people that you would like to reach out to you? Is it companies or is it
students? It could be potential employees. It could be potential sponsors. It could be somebody who's just interested in the kinds of things we're doing for the community and for our sponsors.
Now, Lynn, if people want to learn more about the awards, is there a website for you guys?
Absolutely. They could go to Turknet, T-U-R-K-N-E-T-T.com, or leadershipcharacter.com. And we'd love to have nominees for next year and sponsors.
Well, thank you so much for putting this group together. It was really inspirational, and you guys are doing important work out there.
Thank you. It was great for me, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Lee Cantor for Stone Peyton. We will see you all next week on Results Matter Radio.
This has been a joint production of Burr and Foreman and Business Radio X. Burr and Foreman is a full-service law firm with offices across the Southeast. If results matter to you and you want them to matter to your law firm, please give Burr and Foreman a call at 404-685-4337. For more information and to find the right attorney for you, visit burr.com. That's B-U-R-R.com.